It's wonderful.
The Committee on Education will be in order. And I love to check and see if a quorum is present, although we are not planning on taking any votes today. I want to welcome all of you here and welcome our many new members. I think this is going to be an exciting year, and we've got a lot of fresh energy being brought to the challenges that face us in education. So we're going to be starting today with just some introductions so that we can get acquainted with who's at the table and who are the support folks around here that will be helping us in the Education Committee, and then getting to know one another a little better, because it's we have 10 members that are of the 17 that are new to the Senate Education Committee. We have one that had a little hiatus and is back, and we welcome her. Senator Scheid, I think, has just passed behind me. And we have only 6 that were serving on this committee in the last term. So we do need to get acquainted. And I will share some of my thoughts on where we are going and how we will function. And then we have one presentation today, as is on your agenda. Let me start with having the staff that is at the surrounding me here to keep me in line, no doubt. Why don't we start with you, Eric?
My name is Eric Nauman. I'm part of the Senate fiscal staff. I've been working on this committee for about 14 sessions now.
Great. And Casey?
My name is Casey Peterson. I'm Senator Olson's LA.
Casey Peterson?
And Greg Marcus, I'll be working as the committee administrator with Senator Olson in the Education Committee.
Ed Cook, I'm with Republican Caucus Research.
Anne Marie Yunker, I'm the counsel for this committee, and I've been working on this issue for 15 years.
I'm Shelby McQuay. I am the research analyst for the committee, and I have been with the Senate in this committee for, this is my 7th session.
Well, welcome all, and know that you've got some good expertise here surrounding and available to help each of you on the issues, and we'll be talking further about that. Let's go down to the right here. Carla is our vice chair, and so we'll start with you.
Thank you, Chair Olson. I'm Carla Nelson. I live in Rochester. I represent District 30, which in addition to Rochester is Chatfield, Dover, Eota, Elgin, Plainview, and Stuartville. That's Olmsted and Wabasha counties. I'm a former teacher, taught in the Rochester Public Schools at the elementary and secondary levels. I'm a special ed teacher and also a reading specialist at the elementary and secondary levels. My parents are both public educators. My mom was a special ed teacher and my dad a principal. Actually, he was my high school principal, so that was kind of interesting. My master's is from the University of Minnesota in teacher leadership. I am new to the Senate. I did serve in the House several years ago on the Education Policy Committee. I'm thrilled to be on this committee. I think there's a real opportunity here, and I guess the one thing I would hope, and I'm sure that it's probably all of our views, that is we make these decisions about education that we always put the needs of the student first. Thank you.
Thank you, Carla. And I just want to acknowledge that Senator Stumpf, who chaired this committee for 8 years, well, I was the lead minority, and we've reversed roles. I'm glad he's back as the lead DFL, but he is not here today. I believe he is traveling in northern Minnesota with the governor. So he will, yes, he but is. He will be back. And who are we missing here next? Okay, there's an extra chair in here, Sean.
I'm Sean Nano. I am serving my 2nd non-consecutive term. Previously did serve on the Education Committee. This will be my 3rd year now serving on this committee.
I'm Terry Bonoff. I represent District 43, which is Minnetonka, Plymouth, and Medicine Lake. This will be my 6th year on education. I previously was the Vice Chair of Education, and I'm very happy to be back.
I'm Senator Al DeKreif from Senate District 25. I represent all of Le Sueur County, most of Rice, not including Faribault, Southern Scott, and part of Sibley counties. My children, I and my wife are both educated public education. My children were educated public education. I have a son that's disabled, and was educated. He was born with cerebral palsy, so I understand the needs of the special needs children in school. And now I have two grandchildren, and I want to make certain that we offer world-class education here in Minnesota. And I want to make sure as well that the funding is fair throughout the state. Some of the outstate areas, I think, are underfunded. I want to make sure that we correct that problem. And the children will come first in my mind.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, my name is Patricia Torres-Ray. I represent District 62, which is Southeast Minneapolis. I have two children, 16 and 14. They both go to public schools. And this is my fifth year in this committee.
Senator Benjamin Cruz, I represent Senate District 47, which is Brooklyn Park, Champlin, and Coon Rapids. Little bit about me. My background is very much small business orientated. I have been in restaurants for over 16 years, ran restaurants for 7 years, have spent the past six running a real estate business. Am absolutely delighted to be on this committee. I have a passion for education, a passion for children. I honestly believe that other than making sure folks can put food on the table and roofs over their heads, providing an education for our children is the highest priority. So I feel blessed to be on this committee and work towards that.
Pam Wolf, Senate District 51. I have Blaine, Spring Lake Park, Moundsview, and part of Fridley. I have six school districts, and I think I've taught in four of those school districts. I currently teach at Pine School in Lino Lakes. I'm licensed in health, PE, special ed, and coaching, and highly qualified in social studies and science. And I'm looking very forward to being a part of this committee.
Thank you.
Roger Chamberlain, Senate District 53, first term, first time on the committee, looking forward to serving and helping out the kids in schools. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Katie Sieben from Senate District 57. My school districts are South St. Paul, South Washington County, and Hastings. I have a three-year-old son and just finished a second session of ECFE with him on Monday.
Great.
Congratulations, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
I'm Ted Daly, Senator Ted Daly from Eagan, and represent Eagan and the eastern part of Burnsville. I am a Preston Fountain High School graduate. Preston is south of Rochester, about 30 miles, and I went through public schools there. And as I like to say, my parents got their money's worth when I was in second grade. It was the best 3 years of my life. My kids are all, we have four children, my wife Dawn and I have four children, and they are all going through the public schools, Independent School District 196 in Eagan, and I keep them in mind when I make these kinds of decisions here, class sizes and the results, the things that they're experiencing. So I have firsthand experience as a parent, and education is very important, and it's an honor to serve on this committee with you. Thank you.
Linda Scheid. I live in Brooklyn Park in the Osseo School District, but represent the city of Brooklyn Center as well. So I also represent the Anoka-Hennepin District, Robbinsdale, and the Brooklyn Center School District, where I've done a lot of substitute teaching in the last 10, 11 years. I left the committee for 2 years, and I was very distressed over that. So I'm really glad to come back on. Regardless of what happened in the election, I mean, assuming I was going to win, I was wanting to be back on the Education Committee, and I'm proud to serve with you, Madam Chair. I've served on the committee with you these many years, I think 12 of the 14 years that I've been in the Senate. My children are products of the Osseo School District, and I just attended my 50th high school reunion at St. Louis Park in August, so I'm strong proponent of a strong system of public education. It's vital. And I'll say that having my children did attend a private senior high school, but I'll always say that parents
have the responsibility and the absolute right to make that decision about where their children will go to school, but that we must have the strongest possible system of public education that we can put forth. And Minnesota has a proud history of that, and I'm quite confident that we're going to be able to continue to do that. It's not going to be easy, but we must. So thank you.
Thank you.
Dave Thompson, I come from the Lakeville-Farmington area and have a number of the townships and smaller towns south and east of Farmington. Graduated from high school up in East Grand Forks, Minnesota, so smaller town area. My wife was from a small town close to there. She had one of the larger graduating classes out of that city of 22. And but now, of course, I live in Lakeville and very much on the opposite end of the spectrum, large public school. I'm honored to be here, looking forward to the opportunity to work with all of you, and looking forward to hopefully getting some legislation passed that, helps the system here and, most importantly, helps the students in Minnesota.
Hi, my name's Chuck Wieger. I represent Maplewood, North St. Paul, and Oakdale. 39 years ago, I was an intern for this committee, and Jerry Hughes was the president of the Senate and the chair of the Education Committee. I really liked it, being a part of that team, and said, I want to run for school board. I did. I was elected at 21 and served there for about 18 years. I've been the senator for my area now for into my 15th year right now. My five children are grown, public school products, college, they're complete with that. I share your passion for education. It's my highest priority, and I have a conflict because I'm booked on the Environment Committee, and we're going to resolve that very soon.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Senator Wieger. And Senator Harrington is in the same boat, and I think if he comes in here a little later, we'll introduce himself too. Hopefully we can get that corrected, because I think we need all of the energy. And I'm Jen Olson. From Senate District 33, which is western Hennepin County. I represent 20 of the 44 cities in Hennepin County. Major school districts, large parts of two other large school districts, and smaller parts of four more, so eight school districts that are kind of both the kind of rural and growing as well as suburban districts. And I have served in the legislature now for 28 years, and I'm not sure if it was the first year or the second year that I was able to get onto the Education Budget Division. They did not allow freshmen on it, but I came, as I've even counseled some of you, to, if there's something you're interested in, come. You can sit at the table. You can ask questions. I did. And Senator Tom Nelson was the chair of the committee at that time. He came up to me after at our meeting with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts the other day with a big smile on his face and reminded me, because he's the one that got me on the committee, said, I think there's room for one more and I'd like to have you on it. So I cracked that back in my freshman term and have been with education in its various iterations of policy and budget ever since. And so I'm looking forward to the opportunity. I think our Senate committee, I'm proud of the Senate in terms of its dealings with education. I think we've got a track record of having healthy, vibrant discussions. We don't agree on everything, but we've been able to progress some ideas and needed changes. Probably, maybe I'm biased, but a little more vigorously than the other body. And I hope we can continue to lead in that way and hopefully continue to be successful in advancing the needs. Because there is need, and we're going to be hearing more about that. We cannot rest on our laurels. There's many that are discovering that we have not made the progress in closing the achievement gap. And we have the challenges not only of the needed reforms to assure improved learning, but we also have the constraints of not having additional resources. And so we need to be continuing to look at how and trying to find the ways that we can invest the $14 billion that we will spend in this committee in ways that will bring the best return for those results. I was reminded, I think it was Greg that did a little calculation. If all of the students that we had were in one-room schoolhouses, and there were 10 students per teacher, there would be $100,000 available for the teacher based on what we now have. So, you know, people brought their own lunch and they often walked to school. There's a lot of things that have come to bear. But we need to look at what is it we're doing that we might not have to do? How can we use our resources in the very best interest of the students? We will have a challenge here with our committee meetings. And by the way, I do want to introduce our pages today. We've got two Barbs, Barb Miller and Barb Suzanne, who are filling in until next week when we will have our permanent page, who is Carrie Schwab. And the page is available to run errands, whether it's to deliver a message or do other things while we're in committee, and we'll be seeing, too, that things are distributed to us. And so that is their role. And I think we have some caucus staff here that I didn't mean to pass you up, so would you introduce yourself to the group as well?
I'm Dan Elling. I'm with DFL Research. This is my 14th session with the Senate and committee, and I have daughter in Eastern High School. My daughter is a sophomore.
Wonderful. Great. Thank you. Well, thank you very much, and I am excited about all the energy that I hear around this table, and so looking forward to what we can do. I would encourage everybody, I'm going to try, because I haven't always been the best behaved. I've had that long trek over from the state office building, to be here on time. We are scheduled for only 1 hour and a half meetings, and an hour and a half can go pretty rapidly. And so I'd encourage people to be on time and be able to stay with us so that we can operate as efficiently as we can. I will also say that I want to encourage you. I don't know that I'm going to make commitments to hear every bill, but we because of the challenges and constraints that we have in terms of funding and our needs for reform, I really welcome any ideas that you have for how we might work within those challenges with ideas to improve results within our existing resources, or what we might do to free up our districts to be responsive to what they know are their needs and sometimes feel that they have their hands tied. So I hope that you are all thinking in some of those terms and understanding that we, like most of the states in the country, are looking at flat funding, and our hope is that we don't have to cut, that we might be at least able to stay stable in terms of our education funding. So we're going to begin our focus on some of the reforms and discussion of those, and we will soon be hearing bills to that end. We're going to try to organize them around topics and get some background information that with current law and with the department's role and that in relation to the subjects that we will be taking up. I have talked with Eric Nauman in our fiscal staff, and Shelby and Anne-Marie, and I think I understand that they have been meeting with some of the new members, and whether it's in a private tutorial or a smaller group, I know other members of our caucus that are new would like to be involved in any kinds of instruction. So rather than take a lot of committee time until we're dealing with some of these specific areas, I would encourage you to get some of that tutorial of how our funding is structured. We don't have as many agencies to deal with. We do have a number of boards. We will be having a fair number of confirmations to do as well, the chief of which is the Commissioner of Education. So those are some of the other responsibilities we have and that we will be undertaking as efficiently as we possibly can. Today, we have with us the first of our presentations from Cecile Rattel from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And she has a presentation that she's going to present on a prepared workforce and needed education reform. So would you like to have questions while you're presenting, or would you rather go through your presentation and wait until you're completed to respond if there's questions that are raised?
Madam Chair, thank you. I think it's probably easiest if we cover them while we're going, unless you think otherwise.
Okay, before you start, I see that Senator Harrington has joined us. Would you mind just giving a brief introduction to our attendees and the rest of our members?
Senator Olson, members of the committee, apologize for being late. I'm double booked at this point. I'm still trying to figure out how to get to both places at once. My name is John Harrington. I'm the new elected senator from District 67, which is the far east side of St. Paul in Ramsey County. My background is 33 years in law enforcement and 24 years in higher education with a master's in adult education. And I'm happy to be here.
Great. Thank you. Welcome. And I did miss identifying Senator Han, who apparently has a conflict and is not here today, but I know will be joining us and will continue to have his active interest in education evident for us. Okay, Cecile.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Cecilia Rattel, and I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Just to get started, we have actually been doing a very similar presentation like this all over the state this summer. These are the ones that we've done in the last 6 months, but obviously that doesn't back all the way up to, you know, when session did end. And just looking around this room, there is some familiar faces for people that attended those meetings, and I appreciate that. And these were attended by people from the public, our members, so teachers, principals, school board members, elected officials. It was a great turnout. And we've also had all these yellow dots are local and regional chambers that have actually adopted our education policy, and they're what are called our federation chambers. So they have a required, you know, whatever our priorities are for the year, that they have to adopt all of those policies to be considered a federation chamber. So just to kind of give you an idea that we do have, you know, businesses and representation and input from all over the state. Of the meetings that we had, there were some very clear outcomes that we were accomplishing while doing this. First off, we were educating the public about the upcoming workforce shortage. At the end of pretty much every meeting, somebody would come up to me, and it would follow, you know, be followed up by a dozen emails from other people saying, I saw your presentation online, or I heard it from a friend, or I read about it in the newspaper, and those numbers are shocking. So I'm happy to get the word out, and the education piece is key. Secondly, we did get a lot of input from different parts of the community and people saying, you know, you should tweak this reform a little bit this way or that way, or it would be, you know, more easier to adopt if we did it this way. So we did do a lot of adjustments along the way prior to that last 6 month set of meetings that we had. And finally, we gained amazing support for these reforms. And even today, I've received two emails actually from teachers that read through this presentation, which is on our website, saying, this is great. You know, we love what you have here. Same thing from school board members and a lot of parents. We're starting to hear a lot from parents getting involved, which is always a wonderful thing to hear. So with that, we'll get started. Last year, as many of you have heard about, we had some missed opportunities. You're familiar with the race to the top. In round one, there was the state was able to apply for it was more of an RFP. So there were certain standards that the state had to meet in order to get certain number of points on the application. In round one, Minnesota was one of 41 states that applied, and it's actually 40 states plus D.C. So we finished 20th, and there was two winners in that round, one that received $100 million, and that was Delaware, and then Tennessee received $400 million. And we've put those numbers out there because we think about the shortfalls that we have right now and the you know, issue that we're having right now with money in this state. And the application that we used was all of the status quo, you know, same laws that we've had because we weren't in session when that first application was due. However, after the first round, we got the feedback, and we had some significant adjustments that needed to be made, but we also got a lot of feedback from Secretary Duncan's office about what needed to change in order to be, you know, really a contestant in round two. However, you know, none of those laws passed, and so we weren't able to apply for round two because it would have been the exact same application as round one. So in round two, there was 35 plus D.C. states that applied. And as you know, Minnesota did not apply. And there was actually 10 winners in that round. And those awards ranged from $75 million up to $700 million. I believe in that round, we were eligible for $200 to $250 million was the range that Minnesota qualified for. So the key here is there will be, hopefully, you know, more opportunities in the future. And from what we've heard from the governor's office, we're very pleased to hear that he is wanting to look into the reforms that were a part of Race to the Top and possibly, you know, put something together that would make us competitive for that next round and any future opportunities that would come up. Some facts about Minnesota that some people are very familiar with and others are shocked by. The first one is we have 50% of our kids showing up for kindergarten unprepared. There's a lot of things going on right now that, you know, don't allow parents to have the same kind of input that they used to. One thing that we've built, that we've endorsed now, and we've helped build over the summer, is a website called isyourchildready.com. And it allows for parents to go online and put in different types of things that their kids do. So then it breaks it down into the different cognitive development stages. So you put in the age of your child. Right now they have 3-, 4-, and 5-year-old data up on there, so you can do it. It's all free. And in the next couple of years, they'll add 2-year-olds, 1-year-olds, and then newborns, and things that you can do with your child so you'll know, you know, yes, my child is really good identifying numbers, but they can't, you know, distinguish different letters. So just different things that will allow parents to have a tool to use to get ready for kindergarten. Next, Minnesota has one of the largest achievement gaps in the country, and so this is the differences between what we call advantaged and disadvantaged kids. So this can be race or socioeconomic. It's just not acceptable, and we'll get into some more of the details about that. Finally, the Teacher Quality Counts report from 2010, which came out just about a year ago today, rated Minnesota a C, and we were 29th in the nation. I haven't had a chance to look, but my understanding was this was in the Star Tribune today. So there is updated information about the 2011, and so I don't know what the numbers are. From my understanding, we actually now are a D+. So something that we need to keep in mind as we move forward. So getting back to the achievement gap, in 2009, and when I did this in, you know, public forums or at companies, I would ask people, so, you know, try to guess the percentage of kids we had graduate throughout the state. And without a doubt, every single stop, somebody would be, you know, saying 90, 89, 92%. So everyone's, people that aren't familiar with the subject are always shocked when they see 75. But then when you get into the disparities between our white students, which are graduating at 82%, and our students of color that are graduating between 41 and 68%, it becomes very clear what we're talking about when we talk about the achievement gap. Next, when you look at the demographic shift that's happening in the next 10 years, and this is from the Minnesota Demographer, we see that the students that are on, you know, in the groups that are graduating between 41 and 68%, are the same groups that are going to be growing in the next 10 years, and the white population is going to be shrinking. So we think about this in a triad form, which we'll show in a second. And the third part of this is the workforce shortage. So there was a study this summer out of Georgetown that showed that in just now 7 years, 70% of our jobs in Minnesota are going to require post-secondary training. So it's not that every student has to be going into 2- or 4-year colleges. This can be a certificate or some sort of an employment program. The bottom line is they have to graduate from high school. And when right now we're only 5% above that, but our demographics are shifting, we know that we're not going to be able to meet that number. I talked to some people from DEED to try to figure out what that percentage is currently, and the number that they could get the closest to is currently it's about 40%. So you see the shift happening in the type of jobs that we're going to have available, and that gets us into our next point of this growing disconnect between the jobs available and, you know, people that can fill them. So just another issue. So when you look at these three things, you realize that Minnesota's workforce is clearly in trouble, and to get students prepared, you know, if we're talking 7 years out, those students right now are in middle school, and something needs to change immediately. So we went back to our committees and talked to our different community members, and our goal for each student is to, you know, be like this. She's successful, she's happy, she's enjoying school, and we came up with a 3-tiered approach for this. Our first priority will be having an effective teacher in every classroom. Secondly, having students reading at grade level by the time they exit third grade. And then finally, increasing high school graduation standards. So this first one, an effective teacher in every classroom. We know that teacher quality is the number one predictor of a student's success. There's no doubt about this. We know we have great teachers, and high quality ones are going to help those students. Secondly, they influence students second to parents. Of course, the issue is that we can't legislate parenting. So we have to work on what we can legislate, and that gets us to the second one, which is teachers. Finally, teachers' impact is both additive and cumulative. And if you are like me and a little bit more visual, the next slide talks about this. So this is two groups of students that were in Tennessee, and in Tennessee they did have a teacher evaluation system. So one group of students, and when they were all at that yellow dot, so the starting point on the screen, they all had the same or similar backgrounds, same achievement levels. They were expected to have the same outcome in 3 years. However, one group of students was put with high-performing teachers and the other was put with low-performing teachers. And after only 3 years, there was a 53% point difference. And this is in 3 years. And when you start extending this over the 13 years that we have kids from kindergarten to 12th grade, it's unbelievable when you start thinking about which path you want your kids on. So very key that we get this done. We took a look at some of the work that the New Teacher Project has been doing. They're a group out of New York, but they've done work all over the country, including in Minneapolis. And they did a survey of 15,000 teachers and principals in four states. And as a disclaimer, one was not Minnesota, so this study did not include Minnesota, but one that did was Colorado. And prior to their bill that they passed last year, the laws in Colorado were very similar to the laws that we have here and the way that our school system works. So... Oh, sorry, we reordered slides. So this slide we actually inserted because I was up north, and the next slide was actually before, and somebody said, you have tenure spelled wrong. And I couldn't figure out what they were talking about, so I said, I'm sorry, how do you think it's spelled? And she said, well, isn't it 10 years? So it's not. So if that's what you thought, you aren't the only one. So this is just very informational. There's not really anything in it. Gives you kind of the background of what tenure is in Minnesota. Next, so now the New Teacher Project. This is the survey done with 15,000 teachers and principals. Colorado was involved along with three other states, and this was the results that they found. 4 to 5 probationary teachers are confident that they would receive tenure. So these are the teachers that are in those first 3 years. Those are probationary, so they have not yet received tenure. Next, 54% of all tenured teachers agree that tenure is a validation of their teaching skills. And every time I read this percentage, I always wish I had the follow-up question of, you know, what do the other 46% think they're getting it for? So that's always kind of troubling to me. And then finally, 90% of the probationary teachers were receiving the highest grading on their performance evaluation. And this is key because this was done on a tri-level, so they had three options for evaluations. They were either, you know, ineffective, effective, or highly effective. And they found that when there's only those three, and this wasn't the only study they've done on the evaluation piece, but that when there's three levels, 90% get the highest level, and when there's two, it's closer to 99%. So you can see people don't want to do that, yet when there's four levels of rating, then they actually get some real data and some actual, you know, constructive feedback. So that's one piece that we'll be working on this year. The last thing that we found in this study that was very interesting was that 38% of teachers and 58% of principals agree with the statement that there's tenured teachers in their school who should be dismissed for poor instruction. So even the other people in those buildings are able to identify the teachers that need some work. And even though Minnesota wasn't included in this study, this was a report that the Star Tribune did last year about some of the stuff that's going on in Minnesota. And also, I talked to the Anoka Hennepin superintendent, and he said for the last sentence, just to be fair, they asked fired, not you know, exited. So they have worked with exiting teachers, but there is not an easy way to fire them. The Minneapolis School District, they did this to not have to pay the teacher or pay for legal fees of $100,000 to $200,000, which is about the average that it takes to do it through the system. The first sentence, I have nothing for. So our bottom line here is that we need to have some conformity to our teachers' evaluations statewide so that we can identify the highly effective, effective needs improvement, and ineffective teachers. We can recognize the master teachers and get a mentoring system put into place. And finally, professionally develop the effective and needs improvement teachers into being highly effective teachers. Because we know we have great teachers out there, and we just need to give them maybe that little extra bump for something that maybe they were never trained in or they haven't had experience in those types of classrooms. And one of the things that, from my understanding, people have kind of been talking to me about the article in the Star Tribune today, is that one of the things, excuse me, that they talk about that Minnesota does not do a very good job of is putting our highly qualified teachers in front of the students that need them the most. So that's something else that we really need to work on. Next, this is we looked at a school here in St. Paul that is a charter school, so it doesn't have to follow the current tenure laws the way they are. And instead of using tenure to evaluate or, you know, employ teachers, they use student evaluations. And let me emphasize, you know, I'm not trying to say that all charter schools are the end-all, be-all. It's simply a way to look at what teachers are able to do with students when the principal and the district isn't held down to keeping, you know, the status quo system in place. So this school is made up of 70% of students of color and 87% of low-income students. As I said, it's a public charter school, and the principal has complete control of this building. They have extended school hours. They've introduced a four-year-old program. They do a summer school program in June and July where they have the students for 3 weeks each month. The teachers took a pay freeze for the last 3 years so that they could buy vans, extended vans, to go pick up students from all around the city. Because they have this high percentage of low-income students, we know that these students are the ones that are moving around the most. So in order to keep them and retain them in their building, the teachers pick them up in the morning. And the most impressive part of this whole story is this slide. So the yellow bars, the first three on the left are reading. In 2008, the state average was 79% of third graders meeting or exceeding standards statewide, and Concordia Creative Learning Academy was at 42. In 3 years, they went from that 42% up to 100% of their third graders meeting or reading, like meeting or exceeding the level. Same thing for math. They went from 67%, which was under the state average, to again 100% this year, meeting or exceeding the standard. So we know it can be done, and, you know, excuses can't be made. Another thing that the school does use is they have a few Teach for America teachers, and there's been a lot of talk about, you know, what are alternative pathways. And all summer we use this slide as being or as a way to talk about, you know, educating the public, because there are a lot of misconceptions about what it is and what it does. A great example of this is Teach for America. They are a highly qualified program and highly respected throughout the country. And the other thing is, we're not trying to say that, you know, an alternative pathway is better or an alternatively licensed teacher is better than a traditionally licensed teacher. I do have my teaching license through a traditional pathway, so that would be kind of, you know, not nice to say. Anyways, so the couple of differences is, for right now, Teach for America, the teachers are required to pass their tests before they enter a classroom. Right now, for traditionally trained teachers, you're actually able to receive 3 one-year waivers. So you could be in a classroom for 3 years without having to pass those basic skills tests. Next, there's no specific data about how much student teaching is the right number of weeks. So student teaching for Teach for America is a 6-week program in South Chicago over the summer. For traditionally trained teachers, it's a 10-week program. The one that I did in 2009 was in Robbinsdale District. And it's really, so you've got 10 weeks, the first 2 weeks you observe, and then starting that third week, it's called ramping up. So the first week you do, you know, just reading, then the second week you do, or the now fourth week you do reading and math, fifth week you do reading, math, and social studies, then the fifth and sixth week you do have the class to yourself with the door shut, so you've got those 2 weeks to yourself, then you ramp back down a little slower, and then the last, you know, week to 2 weeks, depending on the program, you spend a lot of time in other classrooms in the building. You go to special ed. You go and, you know, spend a day with the principal. It's a completely different type of experience, and it's a different way to get your teaching license. And when we say more mentoring in the first 2 years, this is because the program is completely different once again. Teach for America is for teachers that are already done with their undergrad. They are not, you know, 18, 19, 20, 21-year-olds. So when the teachers that go through the traditionally trained programs, those, you know, once you're in the classroom, you have your teacher of record that's with you, but you don't have the same type of mentoring that you do when you're in Teach for America for 2 years, where they're constantly giving you feedback and helping you manage your classroom. Another common misconception is that if the state passes this law that the entire, you know, every district's going to be flooded with them and they're going to have to take these teachers. That's not the case. It just allows for districts to use this as an option. It gives them another tool in their, you know, tool belt to pull out if they really need, you know, say a chemistry teacher or a special ed teacher. Next, it doesn't take jobs away from other teachers. It is, once again, just another option for districts that maybe need a specialized teacher in an area. Another great kind of way to perceive this is in Worthington right now, they've had a huge influx in the number of students that need second language services, and they don't have the teachers there that are able to serve those kids. This would be a perfect type of opportunity. You could put Teacher America there teaching, you know, English as a second language classes, then they're also able to teach this or speak in the student's native language, and that'll help the students to learn English quicker. Next, all 42 teachers that operated under the one-year waiver for Teacher America last year in the state were part of the teachers union. And finally, the Board of Teaching continues to serve as the gatekeeper for all teaching preparation programs in the state. So that's another one. QComp, this is one area that the state did get some points last year on our Race to the Top application, but at the same time, there are some areas of this law that we still can strengthen. In doing the meetings, I heard from some superintendents that told me, you know, they can do this, but they still can use the step-in-lane pay schedule for up to 90% of their pay. So clearly there is some work still to be done on here. The idea is excellent. You're, you know, structured professional development and evaluations, and you have the pay schedule is based on performance and not just seniority. But like I said, there is some more work that needs to be done on it, and there is still money available in this fund, and it's a first-come, first-served basis. And so like we've told local districts throughout the state, if there is a round three for Race to the Top, we've heard that it would likely be on a district level. So this is something that districts would want to have if they're going to want to apply for that. Of course, the more options. Sorry.
Excuse me. I was going to just say, maybe when you finish this slide, we could stop, and if there's any questions, give you a break for breath. But also, if any of you have questions that you would like to pursue any detail of any of the things that you've brought up so thus far?
Yeah.
Is anybody going to have a burning question? Soaking it all? Nope. Okay. But, well, at least you got some breath.
Thank you. Okay. And as of 2009-2010, the Minnesota Department of Ed had approved 44 districts and 31 charter schools to use the QComp model. So our main objectives here for our first priority are very kind of simple, as we've already talked about. The first one is requiring a standardized teacher evaluation in all districts and requiring that 50% of it be based on student data. The other 50% would be up to local, you know, decision, whether it's one that they've been using or have in place, and it would start you know, as the students come out of school. So this is something that we think is key to getting the most effective teachers in every classroom. Secondly, the alternative pathways, which we just discussed, and then requiring that teachers pass that basic reading skills test before they enter a classroom. And then finally, locally, we, of course, are supporting districts that want to enter into the QComp program. Our next priority is requiring reading at grade level by the time a student exits third grade. The amount of feedback we have gotten on this initiative and priority is quite honestly unbelievable. This graph kind of illustrates a lot of what we're talking about. So in the beginning of fourth grade, students take this NAEP test, and this is the percentages of students that are meeting the basic level on that test. And what they have found, and this isn't just one set of numbers that it happened to be close and we use that. There's been multiple studies that Ann Casey Foundation is a great resource to look at, that the students that are not reading when they leave third grade are the same ones that aren't graduating. And when we look at this and we know that we could intervene 8 years earlier and we're not, that's just not acceptable. Reading at grade level is really important because up through third grade, children learn how to read, and you'll hear this probably over and over again in this committee. And after third grade, they read to learn. So if you think about it, you're a fifth grader and you get your science, homework, but you can't read it. Well, now you're behind in science, and then you go to your, math class, and you have take-home problems to do that are all word problems, and you can't read those, so now you're behind in math. You see the cumulative effect that would happen. So this is very simple, our call to action for our second priority. It's requiring reading at grade level by the time a student exits third grade, and tracking reading progression starting in kindergarten, so that if it's not a shocker when this kid, comes in the spring of third grade and, all of a sudden we're realizing that they're still reading at the first grade level. No, they need to be tracked from the moment they're in, whether they're changing school districts, changing school buildings, so that the day they come to that new school or the new district, they can start on their reading program. This is essential to changing our future outcomes. Our third priority is increasing high school graduation requirements. Currently, we have a 21.5 credit requirement, the math or the grad language arts test, and then we don't have a math grad test anymore. It was supposed to be started in 2009, but as many of you know, there was a moratorium put on this for 5 years, so now the students simply have to take the test 3 times. Doesn't matter how they do on it, and we still let them graduate and move on to college or a career. And this is really disheartening, especially in a lot of communities that maybe the students don't go directly to college, but they try to go and start a career. I was up north, and there was a power company that was talking to me about how they have, fresh high school students, so it's not like they've forgotten, but they have students that come to them wanting to start their career, at 18, and they have to take a basic test to get on the power lines. Well, they don't know how to read a ruler. And they said this isn't one incident. This is, multiple incidents over, number of years, because they've never had to take a math class, or they've had, their 3 credits of math, but none of them introduced them to a ruler. Obviously not acceptable. We always hear the numbers that, we have the highest ACT scores in the country. We're obviously doing something really well. So we looked a little bit closer into these new numbers that came out, and as you might be able to see on the very bottom, it's the yellow bar, this first one, is the percentage of students that graduated in 2009. But because we didn't have those numbers, we used 2010 ACT scores. But every year, they're roughly the same. So of the 75% of graduates, 70% of those take the ACT. So now we're already down to 52% of our total kids. And of that, it's 18% of the overall kids that are meeting college-ready benchmarks. So even if we have the highest scores in the country, we still have 82% of our kids that are either not graduating from high school, not taking the ACT for whatever reason, or if they are taking the ACT, not meeting college-ready benchmarks. So we still have a lot of room to do, even if we do have the highest ACT scores. We looked at Massachusetts, who seems to be a leader right now in graduation rates, and tried to figure out what are they doing that we're not. They have a very similar credit requirements for us, but then they also have the set of tests that they call them the MCAs. It's the Massachusetts Comprehensive Assessment, and they have both the math and language arts one, and they have a required score for both of those tests. This year they're going to start science, and in 2014 they're going to start social studies. They also have this education proficiency plan for each student, so that if there is a student that is struggling on one of these tests for some reason, they can actually look at that individual student and say, okay, are they showing up? Are they trying their best? Are they doing what they should be doing? Why aren't they passing this test? So it's a little bit more individualized, and they do give out a limited number of waivers. So it's not the preferred, obviously, and they do have a limit so that it's not a floodgate of people getting waivers, but it does allow for exceptions. And when after they implemented this, you look at their percentage rate, so they're on the right side of those bars, and not only are they graduating, 11% more of their kids, but they don't have that same type of an achievement gap that we do. So our call to action for our increasing our graduation standards, for starters, is to reinstate either the math graduation requirement, or a lot was talked last year about going to an end-of-course exam. The key here would be to make sure that you still have that cut score in place, so it is very clear to not only the teachers and the students and the parents, but the community of what level these students are at when they leave those high schools. So to recap our priorities, we have our first one of an effective teacher in every classroom, reading at grade level by the time a student exits third grade, and then increasing high school graduation standards. Questions, comments? Any more?
Obviously, you know that I've had a passion for that second priority in reading by third grade, and we've had it on our statutes, that requirement, for probably a dozen years. And that didn't seem to budge things either. And we've taken some steps that we hope will start down that path, but it's been slow. What do you suggest can make the difference in terms of starting to move us to achieving the goal that we've had and even had in law for some time?
We've been working with a wide group of people talking about, you know, what is the best thing and how are we going to push this and actually get it enforced. One thing that we've looked at is Jeb Bush's law that he passed when he was down in Florida as the governor, and, you know, no more social promotion, just not allowing kids to move forward, so whether that be a retention type of piece or how we would deal with that in an earlier age. Another option is vouchers. If you have a student in the same district from kindergarten to third grade, and they get to third grade and they still aren't reading at grade level, and you've had them that entire time, maybe giving them a voucher to go where they will get taught is a way to do it. Another thing that's been talked about is certifying schools as teaching reading in the appropriate way, you know, and actually recognizing the schools that are doing it correctly and the teachers that are trained and doing it the right way. So there's been a lot of different types of discussions about what we would, you know, want to see moving forward.
Just one more question. You indicated you've come through a teacher education program and licensure, become a licensed teacher. How well prepared would do you feel? Was that at the elementary level, or what level was it? And how well prepared do you feel you are to go in and start teaching reading or achieving this goal?
Yeah, I'm actually a K-6 licensed teacher, and so I did have to go through a literacy block. I would say that it was not it did not prepare me for what I needed to do for teaching reading. Luckily, I have a lot of family that are teachers and some that are, you know, certified in reading recovery or other types of reading preparation programs. So they were able to help me when I tutored students that needed some reading interventions. It was three classes of, you know, being prepared for literacy, one of them, which was, you know, introduction to folklore, and they sit there the entire time for the entire, you know, 10-week program or class and show you different books that are folklore and then children's picture books and then, you know, sci-fi. And this is an entire class. If any of you would like to see the syllabus, I'm happy to share that with you. The requirement of teaching, you know, phonemic awareness and phonics and that sort of style. That was all done via PowerPoint, and not to bash my PowerPoint, but PowerPoints are not always the best way to learn how to teach other people to read. So I would say that there was a lot of room for improvement.
Okay, thank you. I saw some hands. Senator Thompson.
Madam Chair, Ms. Rattell, Dave Thompson, nice to talk to you. Government has botched up a lot of mandated programs over the years. I think most people are really concerned about No Child Left Behind. Right now I'm dealing with administrators in districts that are really concerned about mandates and so on. Sounds to me as though the chamber position is that we're behind this race to the top notion, and yet that is going to bring with it yet another level of meeting federal standards and federal controls. Do we really want to be in the business of binding ourselves to Washington for more dollars? Is that trade-off worth it in your view?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Thomas?
Thompson, sorry.
Well, at this point, I think the ideas behind the race to the top are some very good ideas. Right now, there is not money on the table for race to the top. The deadline for round two ended on June 1st, and that process has already ended. So moving forward, I think we look at what ideas they put out there and what other states are doing that is moving them forward. So even if we did pass a lot of the reforms that we're talking about or that were discussed in Race to the Top, they would move Minnesota forward, and there are no federal dollars right now tied to that.
Not at the moment, right.
Right. Okay. So, you know, a lot of the options that were out there last year under the Race to the Top, didn't tie, I mean, it's not the same idea of, you know, you have to meet these certain standards. They had more to do, like one of the sections that we lost significant points on was the great teachers and leaders section. You know, types of like, do we have a, you know, wide range of alternative licensure? Do we have a, you know, evaluation? There was a lot of feedback given on those different sections. So the testing part is definitely something that needs to be looked at and renewed, the No Child Left Behind or data, that sort of thing. So there's kind of that break between, we also have to recognize that we are competing in a global economy. And, you know, the Common Core standards and that sort of thing do make the U.S. and Minnesota more competitive. And we know that we have, you know, like I've said, great teachers. We know that we have students coming up that have strong family values and, you know, support at home that we could go up to where we need to be. So without, you know, tying ourselves to the federal government, we do have to also look at ourselves as a country and say, if we want to bring international companies here, we need to make sure that we are preparing the workforce that they need.
Madam Chair, Ms. Rattel.
Senator Cruz.
Like I said before, I come from a very small business background, very involved with the chambers, and one of the things that I continually hear from the local chambers that I deal with is workforce development, workforce development, workforce development. This is what we need to work towards, getting our children better educated to bring more business into Minnesota. A couple months ago, I had an opportunity to go to a biomedical kind of business conference, if you will, and talk to some companies that are actually interested in bringing businesses to Coon Rapids, to Minnesota, and I was hoping you could speak a little to that. I know that we have some tax disincentives, if you will. I think we're working towards correcting those, but I personally believe that not too far behind those tax disincentives, it's workforce development that is causing businesses to leave or not to come to Minnesota. Could you speak to that a little bit for us?
Certainly. Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, yes, we have heard from multiple companies. There was a hearing in jobs today talking about, you know, companies have traditionally come and flocked to Minnesota because we have such an educated workforce. But what we see is when we talked about that, you know, the triad of our demographics are shifting and the populations that are growing, we are graduating between 41 and 60% or 68%. That is not a prepared workforce anymore. And that is something that we have always had here. You know, we don't have the oceans, we don't have the mountains, but we've always been highly educated. And that goes back to this workforce development of if we want to keep companies here, we need to give them the workers they need. And that is why education is essential. Madam Chair, could I touch on the...
Yes, Mr. Trump.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to go back to the mandate piece. I meant to touch on that also. We have heard throughout the state that there needs to be a significant amount of review of the current mandates and requirements that we hold our school districts to and ways that we are forcing them to spend money when maybe they don't all need to use the money in the same way. We know that, you know, Thief River Falls is a very different district than St. Cloud and St. Paul is. So we need to recognize that and really take a look at the mandates, especially the unfunded mandates, and look at what we can do or money that we can spend, you know, more efficiently.
Madam Chair, Ms. Rattel, I find it interesting that the governor himself is reapplying to the federal government for money. Governor Dayton. So you're saying that can't be done.
Ms. Rattel?
Madam Chair and Senator Thomas. Is that right?
Thompson.
Yes, Thompson.
Close
sorry.
Enough.
Well, right now, from my understanding, is that he had a conversation with Secretary Duncan. I'm unaware of that. I'm not privy to those phone calls. There is not a round three that I'm aware of, but he probably has knowledge that I don't.
Senator, I think what he said is he's exploring the possibility of applying for additional. But I don't think there has been action. You know, the race to the top may be the label that Governor or President Obama applies to the what's now No Child Left Behind, all of which is it's a continuum of titles to the Elementary Secondary Education Act that has had some basic core funding for our states, but each of them puts their imprint on it, and that has not been, that was not renewed in the last year or two. They've been working on it, but a new Congress is there and will be working on that, and you know, it remains to be seen what that will look like when it comes out and gets approved, hopefully.
Right.
One way or the other.
Yeah, and a quick follow-up, Madam Chair, is, you know, one thing that you all in your positions can really focus on is that we don't get into the same situation we were in the round one for Race to the Top, where Session was not in, and we had to write our application based on our current law. If nothing changes and we don't change anything, even if the round three isn't announced, I mean, if round three isn't announced till June and the deadline's November 15th, we're in the same position again. So there is a lot that can be done whether or not the Race to the Top, you know, program is happening. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator DeCrave?
Thank you, Senator, Madam Chair. Cecilia, I have a question for you, and it has to do with the third grade reading level. And I actually believe up through third grade, children learn to read, and after third grade, they read to learn. And when I look at the numbers at the graduation rates based on children knowing how to read by the time they leave third grade, I think that's a very important key to this entire process to make sure that we achieve some graduation levels. What in your findings do you think are the major roadblocks that are keeping us or allowing us to pass children through the third grade now without having them read at that level?
Ms. Rachel?
Madam Chair and Senator DeCrife, well, one thing that we don't have in place right now is a system that actually tracks students when they change buildings. An experience that I've shared with Senator Olson is when I was doing my student teaching in fifth grade, we had a student come in to our classroom. After, you know, first couple days, it was clear that he did not have reading skills, but we hadn't received his file yet, so we were kind of stuck on moving him forward. We didn't know if he had an IEP. We didn't know we just didn't know that much about him. He was also an English language learner. So after a couple weeks went by, we finally got his file, and the teacher and the principal of the building realized that they had actually had him in that school in kindergarten and first grade. And we had now wasted two more weeks of the student's life that he wasn't getting services he needed. He wasn't getting the reading interventions that he needed. So things like making sure we're tracking students, especially low-income students that move districts more often.
Could I have a follow-up?
Yes, Senator.
Madam Chair? It seems to me third graders don't drop out of school. So if there's a frustration level found in school, it's found after that level when children drop out and don't graduate from high school. To me, this committee should have a priority to make sure that every student in the state of Minnesota knows how to read before they leave third grade, period. And we have to do, I think, whatever we have to do, no matter what, to make sure we achieve that goal so we have opportunities to succeed afterwards.
Ms. Rattel?
Madam Chair and Senator DeCrife, I agree. One thing that I was talking about, former Governor Jeb Bush, he instated a rule or a law in 1998, and he talked about it in a Wall Street Journal op-ed last week. And one of the things was ending social promotion, and his focus was on, you know, having students reading at grade level by the time they leave third grade. And in those 12 years, the percentages of kids that are no longer, you know, are actually reading at the level has dropped by 11%. So 12 years, 11%. About a percent a year, that would help significantly for where we currently are at.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think there's a couple of Senator Daley.
I have a question and a comment, Madam Chair. The comment is a desire to have, it's about funding. And I've tried to understand the complexity of the funding formula, and it is beyond easy understanding for me. I've heard that there are only two people in the state of Minnesota that understand it, and they're not allowed to drive in the same vehicle together. So one of the things that I'd like to see is that for it to be more transparent and easier to understand. That's the comment. The question I have for you related to funding, as I look at the recap of your priorities, so that the Chamber's priorities, Ms. Rattel, and thank you for taking the time to put this together and to come here to talk to us about this very important topic. Number one, effective teacher in every classroom. Number two, require reading at grade level by the time a student exits third grade. And number three, increase high school graduation requirements. What are your estimates as you went through this process, the metrics on the funding? How much is this going to cost? And I'm not going to hold you to specific dollars, but in general, is this a huge cost or not?
Ms. Rattel.
Madam Chair and Senator Daley, the first one, effective teacher in every classroom, that starts out, you look at, the way that the amount of money that we're currently spending right now, and you really have to reorganize when you do the mandate review list and you start to reorganize some of the ways that we're spending money right now. So there might be some money in training teachers or principals or other administration in how to do the evaluations. But at the same time, like the new teacher project showed us, there are people in the building that already know who the effective and non-effective teachers are. So alternative licensure, that should not have a fiscal note on it. Requiring that the teachers pass the test before they get into a classroom, that should also not cost anything because they're already in there. Students reading at third grade level, that we are working on a fiscal note. We're not sure what that'll look like. That once again goes into looking at, okay, well, what's already happening and how are they already being taught reading and what could we do differently or better or more efficiently? So that's a question mark. And then lastly, the math graduation standards or the math grad test and of course exam. Right now, the math grad test, we actually already spent money on it. They take it three times. They just don't have to pass it anymore. So depending on how we do that, and there has been, in my understanding, there has already been money set for developing the next one that they would have to do. So that shouldn't have another fiscal note on it unless we go to the end of course exam, which is a completely different discussion and a completely different kind of route.
Okay. Senator, I think there was Senator Nelson next.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to commend you on a presentation that focused on student achievement. And that one key area, high-quality teacher, that we do have some control over. And also the fact, and this is where my question comes in, we know that parents are the first and most influential teachers. And while in a sense we don't legislate parents or parenthood, but I wanted to ask you about this resource, which I think gets to this, parents is the first and most influential teacher, and you mentioned the website isyourchildready.com, and I was wondering, where did the funding come from for that, and then do you have any, has it been in place long enough, or can you track the number of parents that have used it and that kind of thing?
Thank you. Madam Chair, yeah. Senator Nelson. So the website isyourchildready.com was developed by a group called MNBEL, M-N-B-E-L, along with some work done by MELF, which is the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation, and then was done pro bono by Gentleman's group that actually perished with his sons in the airplane crash. Was it Sierra Nevada? Is that the correct? I can't remember the name of the company that developed the website. So there was a little bit of a delay in launching it. It has now launched and is up and running. And there is a counter that is supposed to be counting the number of people that go on and use it. And we've also endorsed it as a chamber, and our board did. So if companies, or the goal is to try to get our member companies getting their employees to use it. Because obviously a lot of people work and go on their own company's website so that they can track how their child is developing.
Could I have a follow-up, please?
Yes,
Madam Chair.
Nelson.
In addition to that, has this been taken into the schools, so the parent-teacher, student association, the school districts, the back-to-school nights, all those kinds of things are you also integrating it into the school system itself, or trying to?
Ms. Rattel.
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, that's our goal. This has all kind of been launched and going for about 5 days now. So we got a little bit delayed.
Okay.
And we had a test group run it, so we tried to catch some of the glitches, and then we did have the delay, and so now it is up and running, and I think the official press release will be out in the next couple of days.
Great.
So then we'll try to loop in some more of the districts and that sort of thing.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Senator Nino?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You highlighted well, and we talked about some of the challenges here that result from a graduation rate that isn't what it could be or should be, and the disparities, the achievement gap. And at least priority number two gets to that, and you highlighted the correlation between reading level at grade four, or reading proficiency, I believe it was, at grade four, and graduation rates and that relationship, or if that doesn't exist, the dropout rate is higher, et cetera, although correlation and causality are different things. There is, I think, a lot to be accomplished there. But my question is, can you, and maybe you can't answer this, but can you tell me, have you driven any farther down beyond just looking at, for example, reading proficiency at grade three and making sure that happens, but asking the question of how do these children get to that point? Is there the demographics are marked, or the demographic differences are marked. The non-white demographic versus Caucasian demographic, is there a cultural impact? Is there an institutional thing that's going on? What is it? And can we address that? Well, obviously, in the Education Committee, we can't simply legislate if the problem is too many single-parent families with a non-engaged parent. We can't legislatively fix that, but we can address that maybe in a different committee. Is there a deeper level that you drove down into? My personal opinion is that this might help us fix some of the problem, but it's not going to get to the core cause, the core root, and I'm just asking if you can give us any insight on that.
Ms. Fertel.
Madam Chair and Senator Nienau, one thing that was kind of the Concordia Creative Learning Academy that we were really trying to highlight, and one thing that we've been able to see in study after study throughout the country, is that socioeconomics, what their family background is, what race they are, does not actually impact their ability or achievement levels. So I think that people want to use a lot of those things as, for lack of a better word, an excuse and say, well, we can't because whatever. You know, it's no more excuses. We know that these students can do it. We know that they can achieve. You set the bar high. You set the level high from the day they walk through the door in kindergarten. You might not have as many macaroni art projects, but you will have somebody that's reading when they're in middle school. So it's just a matter of prioritizing what we need from the time, you know, we've got our kids through the door.
I'd like to – I've been struggling with a seeming contradiction, and maybe you can help me with it or if you think it's a fair question. You pointed out the impact of an effective teacher and the gap of having a low-performing teacher and a high-performing teacher as being significant. How did you arrive at your recommendation in the case of reading that if they haven't achieved, that you hold the student back? I mean, I understand the not advancing if they haven't achieved, but does that what does that do? I think there was some small gain. Does that somehow provide some incentive for increasing the high performing teachers? You know, it may cost us more if we keep a student back for another year in the same grade. So there's an expense to that. But I'm having a hard time reconciling. The difficulty, that's a debatable thing as to whether we should have social promotion mm-hmm. or not. But if it isn't the child, you've just said these differences sometimes used as excuses. That shouldn't be what is affecting a student's ability to learn. Help me with that thought process.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. That is exactly the struggle that we have with it. It's not the student's fault if they've been in the same district and getting the same services, and they're still not reading or at the level they need to, which is why we have been talking about, you know, do we give them a voucher option and say, okay, districts, if you don't get these students to where they need to be by the time they're at the end of third grade, then you're going to lose your funding for that child. You know, what is going to push the people that are, you know, running the buildings and are in the schools and in the classrooms to the point of realizing that the current law is serious? These students need to be at a certain level when they are done with third grade.
Senator Bonner.
Madam Chair, as we talk about the achievement gap, I think one of the things that has been the toughest for all of us around this table is that it's so important that those people who are in those districts and who also who represent the people who are in those districts, that their voices are part of the discussion, because it's easy for us to kind of sit back and say, well, you know, we could do this or we could do that. But I just want to remind us that we need to hear from those people who are in the trenches about, you know, what it is like and what are their barriers, and make sure that that this is a two-way street and, mm-hmm. and that all those voices are heard. And so, you know, that means around this table, too, those who represent the places where they're struggling the most, you know, we're anxious to hear from them as well.
Thank you. And we will. That's the intent. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was very glad that you asked the question about, you know, really, what do we do with a five-year-old and a six-year-old, and do we make a five-year-old repeat kindergarten? To me, that's kind of a very humane question, and it's a question about kind of our ability to understand how a child learns. And I'm, you know, I understand why the Chamber of Commerce will, you know, present the issue around labor and how important it is to train people so that they can work in these companies and be successful. But from our perspective and a perspective of parent, you know, I think about some elements about reading. You talk about that. You work intensely during the last few years on this campaign about teaching kids to read. And these components are recognition, repetition, and pleasure. A kid needs to recognize a word, needs to be able to repeat that word, and needs to find joy in reading. And a parent needs to understand that as well. But I don't remember when I had a five-year-old that I was thinking about whether or not he will be successful in getting a job in 3M. I was thinking about, do we find pleasure in reading this book? And is my baby actually finding pleasure in reading this book? And I think Senator Bonoff is correct. We need to talk with some of the teachers and some of the parents that have been successful in these challenging conditions, because many parents who are low income and live in very challenging conditions and teachers are very effective. And I very much hope, Senator, that we are able to invite those parents who are working with other parents and those teachers who are working with other teachers to really understand how do we work with parents to help children understand the joy of reading, because I think this is a very important campaign for Minnesota.
Well, thank you, Senator. I become like a cracked record on this. You know, a child only has one, is a first grader once, the holding back notion aside. But these years march on, and when I hear things that, well, maybe we can get an overall plan for dealing with this in the state. I had it in their little group, the Senator Wieger. There's an effort now to try to, with a statewide literacy, developing a literacy plan. And I asked, when do you think, if we get this, they're preparing for responding to an RFP to get a grant to develop a plan to, I mean, do you get the idea? When would this be implemented, and might we start seeing some results? And the answer was probably 10 years. I'm sorry. I'm too impatient for that. I think that we, you know, and this was in the group that was talking about research-based instructional methods that work. So somehow, I don't know what we can do. You know, we've been trying, and we've taken some steps, but I think there's more that has to be done. And I hope that you join me in that impatience and determine whether we are barrier creators or whether we are door openers to doing and maybe pushing a few people through to essentially change that pattern so that we can, in fact, have kids reading by third grade. And I sincerely believe it can be done. I think we've had the part of it is the subtlety of the low expectations and putting labels on. And I've, you know, visited with Senator Harrington, the superintendent, and talked about this in these very terms. And she's right on. I mean, if the adults in the system can get past what seems to be of settling into a low expectation based on socioeconomic or heritage or whatever, that doesn't translate into that discriminatory action that or belief that really they're dumb or they're not able to learn, when that isn't true. And there's moms in this room that have testified to that and have been committing their actions in life to trying to open those doors because they know this crosses socioeconomic lines, it crosses all lines in terms of children that may be struggling readers. And they know there are ways to deal with that, and we should be doing that. And if ever we should be doing it, it's in the public system. And so we need to set those kinds of expectations. And I'm in agreement. Or otherwise, we've got to find, quote, some alternative pathways in order to assure that these children are not left behind. So that's my latest chapter on that subject.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Madam, Senator Bonoff.
Madam Chair, thank you. Just one last thing, and I would just also encourage us to always talk about early childhood in the same subject, because we know if you start at age 5, if they're coming to school not prepared, that we ought to be tackling the, you know, birth to 5, but particularly 3- and 4-year-olds, what are we doing to make sure that they're ready to learn and read through grade 3?
And thank you, Senator Bonoff. And all of these kinds of terms be thinking of saying, okay, yes, early childhood education is important, but what is it in there that is going to make that difference? So that we zero, somebody mentioned about have we drilled down or have we gotten into the root of where the challenge is? Because I think we need to be looking for that and trying to find the ways to motivate and get that happening. If it means trying to shift some of our current resources toward that end, if we could lick that one, I'll tell you, we would have a legacy, every one of us, if we could lead in solving that achievement gap in reading and math. And we hear it. It keeps coming back, whether it's businesses or whether it's in college. It's the reading and the math. It's those fundamental things. And if we don't get them on the right path at the beginning, these children are filling our ranks of learning disability, emotional, behavioral, at the special ed, costing us more, that if they didn't land there, those are resources that we can spend in other ways. So I just hope that we can keep that focus and do whatever we can to solve that, because that achievement gap is right at the core of the challenge we have, and it's maybe some of our districts don't experience it, but all of them do to a degree. I've told my superintendents, if you have 95% of your kids reading proficiently by third grade, then you don't have to pay any attention to anything I'm saying. And usually their answer is, we need to talk. So it is everybody's got it to a degree. Others have got more challenges with it. And I hope we can really keep some focus on that subject. Senator Scheidt.
Madam Chair, and I don't like to get philosophical. That's probably not even a true statement, but I don't really want to borrow anybody or waste the committee members' time. But one of the things that someone pointed out to me about a year or so ago was, and it was a person who felt offended by the term achievement gap, because there's an implication, perhaps, I don't know how subtle it is actually, that certain children are not capable of achievement. And they suggested that I use the term opportunity gap, and I think that is a different mindset, and if we understand that there are children that will be denied opportunities because of these gaps, mm-hmm. then that's progress, I think. I can't help but think, and something that Senator Bonhoff actually said at a meeting at the Osseo, that we had with some folks from the Osseo District, was instead of saying no child left behind or all children can learn, to look at it in terms, and I think my school district, the Osseo District, is actually going to start using this terminology, each and every child, which I think is better than all, which is this big nebulous group that where you don't see an individual. But if you say each and every, you think of an individual child, every individual child, and I like that attitude. And then it strikes me that it's pretty obvious that if you don't read, you don't do well in much of anything in school. So that I don't know what we're emphasizing in those first 4 years. I understand reading and its priority. I don't know, though, that, you know, does it make sense to be teaching science and social studies and all those other things when a child can't read? I think we need to focus like a laser on reading and literacy. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean to give up on math. I certainly haven't. But without the literacy, there's not going to be much else. Mm-hmm. And we need to really work on that. And there are some nonprofits and private sector efforts in that area that I think I would like to hear from as well. Good. And I think you've been at some of those, if not all of those meetings, mm-hmm. of those groups, the private sector folks that are working on it. So I really appreciate the presentation. Thank you. But I like to think of opportunity gap as mm-hmm. maybe good. More appropriate.
Thank you, Senator Shade. Senator Reher.
Madam Chair, I know we're out of time, but for disclosure, I did author the legislation for third grade reading proficiency. We'll have additional legislation. I did offer, but was not successful, to not have social promotion. And it had a big pushback, but it was the St. Paul superintendent. It was Maria Karstoffen, and she talked about tough love. And I wish she was here to talk about that again, and I hope we can revisit that. As Senator Olson, the chair, mentioned, there is a plan that's being developed right now for literacy. It includes early learning. There's a number of indicators. There are over 150 people, I believe, at the meeting that we were just at. Tomorrow, most of us will be at the One Minnesota Conference, but at 4 o'clock at Hamlin, where Senator Olson and I are going to be, there will be a meeting of the Minnesota Reading Association where there will be dialogue with reading educators to discuss this.
Well, I think we've reached the bewitching hour here, and there's more to, there'll be more to come, but hopefully this is kind of whet your appetite and will feed your thinking processes as to what we have ahead of us. And so thank you very much. We'll keep you posted by email. We'll try to have our meeting announcements, what's being covered in the next week, in your email by Thursdays. So we'll try to keep up with that and feel there's open door and open line communication. If you want to talk with me or any of the staff to either plant ideas or interact of any kind, I welcome it. Thank you so much. I'm looking forward to what's ahead. Yep, I got to remember to use this. It's adjourned.